It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC. He anointed himself the king of pop, but it was a distinction that he had earned. Michael Jackson was the biggest music star on the planet at one point, and at the time of his death, at only the age of 50, he was still able to capture the attention of the music industry and the public, even if sometimes that attention wasn't positive. Steve Knopper has written an extensive biography of Michael Jackson. The Rolling Stone contributing editor interviewed over 400 people for his book, The Genius of Michael Jackson. And we welcome Steve Knopper to the show. Steve, thanks for being with us today.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
With a subject as famous as Michael Jackson, who was in the last 20 years of his life the subject of tabloid fodder, is it hard to separate art and how it was made from the mythology?
It can be, but I found that part of it wasn't that hard, actually. I mean, for a number of reasons. The first is that Michael kept those things separate. You know, when he was working on his music throughout his entire career, everything else got shut out, you know, especially early on when he was making the early albums with Quincy Jones and the rest. He would go into the studio and he would just be there focused, and he would be in there for hours and hours and hours, staying up all night in these dark rooms, putting all the great music together. And so what I did was interview all the people who work with him, the engineers, the musicians, the producers, all the different people who put these records together, and there were a lot of them. And they all had a very specific type of impression of him as Michael Jackson, working musician. And so it was easy to really kind of hone in on that and focus it. And then later in his career and elsewhere in his life, you get into these extraneous activities, the tabloid stuff, all the various issues. I kind of felt like that was a whole separate category, and that required a whole different set of sources in most cases.
But at one point, didn't he have his chimp in the studio?
He did. He sometimes did bring Bubbles into the studio with him. Yeah, in fact, I have a little bit on that in the book.
So a little bit of the eccentricity did enter into the workday.
That's true. You make a good point there. You know, he played games. He brought Macaulay Culkin into the studio when they were making one of the records, and they would run around and have water balloon fights and play video games. And, you know, he would bring the chimpanzee into the studio, and there was silliness and craziness, and he would dress like Michael Jackson. So for sure, you make a good point about that. And I think about sort of extracurricular activity and tabloid stuff. I think more about, like, you know, child molestation and facial surgery and all that different kind of stuff. And none of that stuff served as a distraction to making music throughout his career.
Well, the whole thing comes as a package. You said that all of the major stars are weird in one way or another. Elvis was weird. Brian Wilson was and is still weird. Michael Jackson was certainly weird. Does the fame make them weird, or does the weirdness drive what makes them famous?
That's like asking which comes first, the chicken or the egg. It's an impossible question to answer, but I guess what I would say is that I think you need to have a certain type of personality to make it in show business in general, but more specifically in pop music, to be a pop star or to be in rock and roll. And in order to succeed, you have to have a little bit of weirdness. I mean, all those people that you mentioned, from Mick Jagger to Kurt Cobain, you know, on and on and on, you have to be the kind of person that likes that kind of lifestyle, standing up in front of people and being a certain kind of heavily sexual rock or pop star. Certainly, there's some kind of weirdness that those of us who sit around at a desk all day can't really fit into our lifestyle, into our career ambition.
There are a lot of little details you reveal about the creation of his image, from the plastic surgeries to the style that he developed to break himself away from being Michael of the Jackson 5 into his own persona, the dance moves he studied, the fashion. And these things weren't always from obvious places. For instance, Adam Ant inspired those military style jackets, apparently.
Yeah. Adam Ant took credit for it, and there is a lot of documentation that suggests that that was true. Adam Ant and Michael actually had a little bit of a friendship. Like, Adam came to the U.S. on some kind of promotional tour. I interviewed him at length and visited Michael's house and spent the day with Michael and his family and kind of hung around and met all the Jacksons, which was a little surreal. Here's this kind of, like, punk rock guy from England coming over, and nobody knows who the hell he is, but he was there. And then, of course, he performed a little bit of a surreal performance on the Motown 25 special. And he performed after, if memory serves, he performed after Michael's famous Moonwalk performance. And it was sort of like, oh God, I have to follow that, you know, kind of thing.
Well, you mentioned the Moonwalk and his dance moves, which I think that Motown 25 performance really served as a bit of a really, hey, pay attention to what I can do as a solo artist for Michael Jackson. And when it came to his dance moves, he took them from everywhere. But it might surprise some people that Fred Astaire was an influence for this kid who came from Motown.
Yeah, absolutely. Fred Astaire, Gene Kelly. I mean, Michael would, on the Destiny Tour, just to name one example of how influenced he was and how immersed he was in those old classic dance movies, Michael actually took an early VCR, a video cassette machine, around with him on tour, and a TV on the tour bus, and he was constantly watching old Fred Astaire movies, The Bandwagon on down. And he just was mesmerized by Fred Astaire. And, you know, and there were many other influences, too. I mean, it, obviously, you have to say that a great deal of the moonwalk influence came from African-American culture, moves that he learned from Soul Train, moves that he learned from people like Jeffrey Daniel and Casper and Cooley, who were dancers on Soul Train and kind of developed this backslide move from other sources, and they kind of taught it to Michael directly. And then in addition to that, he also had this influence that came from mime. So when he was a kid, he got to know Robert Shields from, remember the old mime duo, Shields and Yarnell. And Robert Shields had a big toy collection, and little Michael, when he was a kid, would visit Robert's house. And Robert was older, and he would sort of say, go away, kid, you bother me. And then Michael would start asking him questions about miming. And, you know, eventually Robert's moves, the old Shields and Yarnell routine clinkers, influenced Michael's moves in The Robot, and that sort of indirectly led to the moonwalk. So, you know, great artists steal, they appropriate, and that's what Michael was up to, and he grabbed the bits of the moonwalk from a million different sources, and he put them all together and put it into this one amazing dance, and, you know, that's why I think it fits the title, genius.
Michael Jackson did not see the world the way that most people do, and sometimes that can require a bit of a translator. And in Michael Jackson's case, was Quincy Jones able to communicate with Michael in a special way? Did he have a special understanding of his talent?
Yes, I mean, I think so. The way I've been putting it is that Michael and Quincy were two geniuses who were working together in the studio. And Michael heard music. He heard symphonies in his head. And he had to be able to translate those to either someone who played the instrument or someone who could write down the music for him. And Quincy Jones was sort of the ultimate person who did that. Quincy Jones, for a brief period or for a few years there, was kind of a father figure to him. He was, I've been in interviews kind of likening him to Phil Jackson, a basketball coach like Phil Jackson, who doesn't really push you. He's not the kind of coach who's going to scream at you. He's the kind that's going to bring your talent out of you and make you be a leader, sort of without you even knowing it. And that's the kind of personality that Quincy had, and he was perfect for Michael for those three albums. And I also want to just add that after Michael and Quincy stopped working together, Michael continued to make great albums, Dangerous and History and Invincible. So it wasn't all Quincy.
You were able to get access to a recording of a conversation between Quincy Jones and Michael Jackson that was either during or after they both had worked on the movie The Wiz, Berry Gordy's R&B version of The Wizard of Oz. And this is a very interesting recording. It was very telling in how they were able to build their relationship.
Yes, absolutely. I had a source leak me a box of cassette tapes, and Michael recorded himself when he was a young man. He would walk around with a tape recorder in the 70s and 80s, long before iPhones, obviously, and he would record conversations, he would record ideas off the top of his head, things. And one of the conversations that I was able to be privy to was a phone conversation, one of the very first between Michael and Quincy after they'd met on the set of The Wiz. And this was roughly 78, maybe early 79. And Quincy's doing most of the talking. He's rambling, which is I gather, how Quincy talks. And he's going on and on and on. And Michael's kind of going, interesting. And at one point he goes, woo, which was really great. And at a certain point, Quincy's going on and on like that, and then Michael says, I hear music in my head. And then there's this pause, and Quincy kind of finally gathers himself and says, Michael, if you hear music in your head, I can help you write that down. And to me, I felt very lucky to have been able to listen to this conversation, because to me, that was the moment of their partnership, when it sort of was the moment of conception, where the two of them figured out what their roles were and how they were going to help each other make an amazing and very profitable record.
We're talking with Steve Knopper. He has written an extensive biography of Michael Jackson. It's called The Genius of Michael Jackson. One of the things that's interesting about that relationship as you describe it and Michael Jackson's career is that even though you do describe him as taking a very strong hand and stronger as his career advanced in the creation of his music, he didn't play an instrument, at least not more than just a little bit. So,
right, that's correct.
So he did have to find ways to communicate all of these things that were in his head to other people.
Right.
Did he have unique ways of doing that?
Yeah, I mean, throughout his career, he would hire people, you know, and it got bigger and bigger as he went along. I mean, when he was working with Quincy, he had these two different studio teams, the A-team and the B-team. And the A-team was the big, well-paid by CBS Records group at various famous studios, Westlake and so forth. And that was Quincy and songwriter Rod Temperton and the engineer Bruce Swedeen and so forth. And then Michael had a smaller crew of engineers and musicians at his home studio at Havenhurst, where he lived in California. And he would work on these demos at home. Some of them have come out and have been heard by the public, and they're amazing. And then he would take these demos into the studio, and then Quincy and the gang would kind of Quincy them up. And then later in his career, when he was not working with Quincy, Michael would use all the money that he had to make this record, sometimes millions and millions of dollars, to just keep studio teams all over the place. For the Dangerous record, he would work with Teddy Riley, the great New Jack Swing producer, at one studio or at one part of the studio. And then he'd work with Bill Bottrell, who was his songwriter and collaborator, at another part of the studio. And then he'd have L.A. Reid and Babyface at yet another studio. And he would just bop to these different satellite studios all over the place and check in and visit them. And then sometimes he'd kind of foster this competition where he'd say, "Hey, Teddy, did you hear what Babyface is doing?" And Teddy'd go, "Oh, crap," you know. And that was kind of how Michael worked on the final three albums of his career.
It did seem like he was pretty calculated, as you say, in maybe playing these different teams of studio engineers and recording teams against one another. When you look at the Thriller album, it's interesting to see how it was conceived to be what it became, this massive crossover album. And at the time, he'd had a hit with Off the Wall, and it made a lot of money and had hits. But the idea by both Michael Jackson and by Quincy Jones was, we're going to break down these barriers between R&B and mainstream music. At the time, in the post-disco era, there weren't a lot of radio stations that were playing much of anything that was R&B based, that were just top 40 stations. And MTV certainly had big walls of pseudo-segregation going on.
That's right.
How did they approach Thriller in a way to say, we are going to make this a crossover album?
They were explicitly talking about that in the studio. It was, as you say, it was part of the conception. I mean, I think thesis statement number one was, let's make a great record. But thesis number two was, let's make a record that everybody will listen to. You know, people think of Beat It, the Eddie Van Halen guitar solo, as being sort of the crossover move to get onto white rock radio stations. And that was certainly true. But it's a little bit forgotten. It was big at the time, but it's kind of forgotten that the first single was The Girl Is Mine, which was a collaboration between Michael and Paul McCartney. And so a source of mine, a great former music executive who studies this stuff named Steve Greenberg, he's written about this a little bit, and he called that song the Trojan Horse. That was the one that they brought to pop radio in the post-disco era to these top 40 stations that weren't playing a lot of African-American or urban or R&B music, whatever you want to call it. And they were like, "Hey, it's Paul McCartney," you know? And that's how they sort of, I mean, it's funny today to think about it, but that's how they kind of shoehorned Michael Jackson back into top 40 during this particularly radio segregated time period. And once that happened, you know, the rest of the Michael Jackson songs, Billie Jean and Beat It and so forth, were pretty much an easy sell.
You open the book with a racially charged incident that happened in Michael Jackson's hometown of Gary, Indiana, before he was even born.
Right.
It's interesting to see how the Jackson family kind of broke out of that. It was a little bit of an extended legacy of the Great Migration and a lot of the African Americans that came to the urban areas in the North from the South. That was Joe Jackson's story. How much did growing up in segregated Gary, Indiana, affect Michael Jackson's view of the world?
Well, it's interesting because Michael Jackson really, I mean, he grew up in Gary, but really only lived there full time until he was about 5 years old, because at that point was when he started to go into show business and travel all across first his region, Chicago, Northwest Indiana, and then the rest of the country and then the rest of the world. But I think it's very significant because Gary, like many northern industrial towns of U.S. history, was very, very segregated. Gary was built as a steel town in the early 1900s, and it was built specifically with rich people living in one place and poor people living in one place and poor black people living in yet another place. And as you can imagine, the place where the poor black people live was not the greatest neighborhood. And so when Michael was a baby, when he was growing up, his frame of reference was he was surrounded by African-American culture exclusively. I don't know for sure, but it wouldn't surprise me if Michael never saw a white person until he was 6, 7, 8 years old and was really starting in show business. And of course, you know, that's kind of a terrible thing in one way because segregation is bad, but also there are things like black-owned businesses and black power and black radio stations and so forth. And all these things were things that Michael soaked in. And so I sort of theorize in the book that he started with such an incredibly limited frame of reference. He was really trapped in this one particular segregated spot his whole life. And then the whole rest of his life, he just started to create a world without boundaries for himself. And the older he got and the more resources he obtained as a rich and powerful pop star, the king of pop, the more he tried to sort of create music that would sell more copies than ever or create sounds that had never been heard or black or white. It doesn't matter if you're black or white. Even his own facial structure kind of went without limitation as part of that theory.
Well, Joe Jackson, his father, didn't really have a lot of options for his career. So it would seem that that was part of why he ruled the family business, being the Jackson Five, with an iron fist. And was it's reported many times in your book, different people have different impressions of what his corporal punishment for his kids was, whether it was to keep them in line or if he was somebody that just couldn't control his temper. But I wonder if the way that Joe Jackson ruled his family and the perceived invisible limitations that maybe he saw of them as of having to do something by themselves because they were limited by race affected what you're talking about with Michael's idea of wanting to break free from this idea of a ghettoized place that his family grew up in and where they were sort of consigned as an entertainment act.
Yeah, I mean, there, you have a little bit packed in there. I mean, one hand, we're talking about the limitations of race and segregation and racism that Michael experienced and his family experienced. On the other hand, we're talking about Joe's approach to disciplining his children. And both of those things had an impact on, and those are interlinked in a certain way, I'm sure, but both of those things had an impact on Michael going forward. You know, Joe wanted to get out of the ghetto. He wanted to get out of this incredibly racist environment that wouldn't allow him any opportunity compared to certainly white people in his region. And I think Michael wanted to get away from his father to a certain extent. And certainly the moves that he made throughout his career and in his personal life kind of suggest that.
It's interesting to note that Michael's long relationship with plastic surgery began right around the time that he started his solo career.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, yeah, from all reports, his first surgery was on his face, on his nose in 1979, and he kept it very much a secret, even to his family. He sort of showed up one day, and actually, the very first surgery that he did was supposedly the result of an accident that he had on stage during the Destiny tour. Although the musicians that I talked to on the Destiny tour don't really remember this, but he came home and suddenly he had bandages on his nose and kind of surprised members of his family. And then he just kind of kept going. He kept going and doing that. And he justified it himself in his book on Oprah by saying, you know, this is what all Hollywood people do. People change their face when they come to Hollywood, when they become stars. It's just something that everyone does. Satisfying answer. I think that he sort of deliberately downplayed it and underestimated the number of surgeries he'd had. But, you know, I think that to an extent, there's all different theories about what he was up to there. Some people say that it was self-hating or that he was kind of trying to get rid of his own father's appearance on his face, that sort of thing. And other people, and I think this is as credible a theory as any, other people say that it was part of his art. You know, he, as I was saying, he had no limitations on any part of his life, and he wanted to live this kind of boundless life where he could just experiment and tinker, and that applied to his facial structure as well.
We're talking with Steve Knopper, whose book is entitled The Genius of Michael Jackson. Unfortunately, what a lot of people thought of during the last 2 decades, really, of Michael Jackson's life and career were a lot of those eccentricities. I don't know if increased isolation that he had, being the most famous pop star on the planet, fed into some of the mythology that surrounded him. After all, he did have his own theme park home. He was somebody that didn't mind every time he stepped out in public being this persona of Michael Jackson. But there were also a lot of things that led to the condition he was in when he died. For instance, when did he regularly start taking prescription drugs?
Well, the first time he ever took a painkiller, a prescription painkiller, from my knowledge and my research and others' research, was after the Hair on Fire Pepsi commercial incident from 1984. And that was the first time he really took them because he needed them. He was in a great deal of pain because he'd burned his scalp. These were serious burns on his scalp. And that pain never really went away. That was sort of the start of it. He was not addicted to painkillers or prescription medicine at that point in his career, but not too long after that, in the early 90s, around the time of the Dangerous Tour, suddenly all this other bad stuff started to happen in his life, certainly the child molestation accusations, that first wave, all the bad publicity that came of that. He started to use more of these drugs more frequently, and in fact, he even announced that he was canceling shows because of that. And then at that point, it's a little mysterious because he wasn't very public about it, of course, but he was kind of up and down with that kind of thing. Some people said that, you know, there was a big trial about this and a lot of testimony has come out about this. But some people said that he sort of used drugs in an up or down way, sometimes on, sometimes off, but sometimes over periods of years. And, you know, I kind of think that explains, I think the story kind of starts to become like Elvis at a certain point later in his life. And certainly when you get to the very end of his life, he had trouble sleeping. He was under incredible pressure to do all these shows financially that he was committed to do through the promoter. And he finally found the ultimate doctor who would give him the most intense sleep drugs. And that was his use of propofol. And that's what, of course, led to his death.
You mentioned the child molestation accusations in that trial. This tabloid narrative people have of him is they think of that immediately, even though he was not convicted of that. Out of your reporting, what was your takeaway from those charges, from the other accusations that were leveled that didn't make it to court?
I went into this. I mean, first of all, what I wanted to do was I went into it with an open mind, and I wanted to get both sides of the story. And I wanted to do the old journalism trick of sort of letting each side try to persuade me that they were right. So I interviewed the prosecutor of the 2005 trial, one of the prosecutors, Ron Zonin. I interviewed Michael's defense attorney, Tom Mazzaro, at length. He was incredibly helpful. I read all the literature on both sides. And I guess I came away thinking, you know, while I am incredibly sympathetic to the point of view that if a child accuses an adult of child molestation, you have to give that child credibility and take them very seriously, I just also felt like I was unable to come up with enough independent evidence of my own to suggest that the standing verdict by a fair and impartial jury of not guilty in Michael's 2005 trial should be overturned. So in the end, I just felt like the evidence definitely suggests that that verdict of not guilty is the one that should stand. Maybe there will be more evidence that comes out. You know, there are other people who are claiming repressed memory, who worked with Michael or were friends with Michael as children, and they're making similar accusations, and some of those cases are pending. But for the moment, I think it's pretty clear that if you look at the evidence in both the early 90s case as well as the trial, I feel like there's nothing that can overturn that verdict.
You made the comparison earlier to Elvis Presley in Michael Jackson's later years. Of course, he would marry Elvis Presley's daughter, one of two of his marriages. He also divorced twice. Early in the book, you mentioned that he kind of shunned girls. There were groupies everywhere when the Jackson 5 would tour in his early teens, and his brothers would have girls over, and that kind of freaked him out at times. What did you uncover about his ability to have real relationships with people and about these marriages?
Yeah, I mean, all I can say is what's been reported. You know, I did talk to one woman named Teresa Gonsalves, she sells books about her experience, and she's been fairly public about the idea that she was Michael's girlfriend and they had a full romantic relationship when Michael was working on The Wiz. And Lisa Marie has come out and said, you know, we actually had a real romantic relationship, and that included sexual relations. And I have no reason not to believe Lisa Marie's point of view. You know, maybe she's still spinning in one way, but she seems to be a pretty blunt talking character. She doesn't seem like someone who lies to the public very often. So, you know, I have no reason not to believe that Lisa Marie and Michael Jackson were in love with each other and were married and all the things that came with it. But, you know, my book is mostly about music and dance and performance, so I can't tell you that I have any sort of smoking gun evidence about what did or did not happen in the bedroom.
With all the tabloid fodder that's out there, it seems that since his death, despite all of the disputes about his estate and his children's custody and the things that came about afterwards, overall, he seems to be redeemed in the court of public opinion. Michael Jackson is someone that is looked upon less like this tabloid figure as the years go on and more as a performer.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's what I was trying to do. I mean, I think that, you know, I've told people before the story that when my daughter was 2 or 3 years old, so around 2004 or five, she got into a huge Michael Jackson phase and she picked up on the song Going Back to Indiana by the Jackson Five. And we had to listen to that freaking thing 400 times a day. You know how it is with 2 or 3 year olds. And, you know, she got so obsessed with young Michael that we had to put pictures of him up on our Christmas tree. And this was, again, this was before Michael had died, and this was right around the time of the trial. And the adult friends would come over and see these pictures of Michael Jackson and our child hanging them up, and they would be horrified by this. And it was really hard to have a real conversation about how great Michael's music was during that time period. And so I feel like the not guilty verdict, and since his death, people have really been able to come back and appreciate him as a performer, as a genius, as someone who has this incredible body of work that I think is up there with the Beatles or Bob Dylan or, you know, anybody that you could name, Elvis Presley, James Brown, you know, on and on and on. And that was one of the fun things about this book, was really coming in and listening to all the music and watching all the videos and replaying the dance steps over and over and over again and really breaking them down. And I felt like it was time for that sort of a journalistic and critical appreciation process to go on.
Steve Knopper is the author of The Genius of Michael Jackson. He's been talking to us this hour. Steve, thanks so much for being with us today.
Absolutely. That was great. Thanks for having me.